Hey, I'm John.
And I'm Becky.
And this is the We Are For Good podcast.
Nonprofits are faced with more challenges to accomplish their missions and the growing pressure to do more, raise more, and be more for the causes that improve our world.
We're here to learn with you from some of the best in the industry, bringing the most innovative ideas, inspirational stories, all to create an impact uprising.
So welcome to the good community. We're nonprofit professionals, philanthropists, world changers, and rabid fans who are striving to bring a little more goodness into the world.
So let's get started.
Becky, it's happening. Are you so
pumped? The
day
is here. Like, after 500 episodes, we literally have the OG of nonprofit podcast in our house today. It's pretty much like having the Beyonce in your house today. Joan Gary is on the We Are For Good podcast. We know that so many of you know Joan Gary. And I don't know why I always say both of her first and last names together, but it feels like it goes together.
It's a Charlie Brown thing. Actually,
totally,
it happens a lot.
Totally. We would not understand what you meant if you said Charlie. So,
correct.
I just think you have an amazing brand. You have an amazing movement. You probably know Joan from any of her best-selling books. She's just an internationally recognized nonprofit leadership expert. She's the founder of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab. She's got Joan Gary Consulting. And of course, you probably know her podcasts, which we want to talk a little bit about today, which are Nonprofits Are Messy. And so, we have a hard time, Joan, going through someone like your bio because there are so many incredible nuggets. I'm going to try to hit the highlights, but we want you to go a little bit deeper because we think your journey is just so interesting. But Joan literally began her career in 1981 as a part of the management team, you know, for a little known something you might know called MTV.
Music television.
I know, John, like, can we talk about you were not even allowed to watch this?
I know.
As a
it
child.
Was like unplugged from my cable somehow. Yeah.
When they actually showed music videos, may I add?
But that was such an incredible start. After that, she made a move to the nonprofit sector. She was named the executive director of GLAAD. We love GLAAD, one of the largest LGBTQ rights organizations in the U.S. And after 8 years there, I got to back something up because I saw something and I want to lift it. When you got there, there was $360 in the bank. How many executive directors out there know that feeling of going into an organization and seeing
the hands are so up in the air, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
Yes, wow. They virtually are. I feel them. So, but after that run, she took this expertise and she became this incredible, successful political fundraiser, co-chairing the LGBTQ Finance Committee for the Obama 2008 presidential campaign. And all of this converged. She's pouring into Joan Gary Consulting. Her blog for board and staff leaders reaches 150,000 unique leaders monthly from over 150 countries, which for anyone who's trying to get reach and exposure, that is just a crazy number. And then we've also talked about this incredible podcast, Nonprofits Are Messy, which has had over 2 million listeners from 207 countries. So that is incredible. And the last thing I want to say, because you know we're always going to end with the personal, is that Joan lives in New Jersey with her wife of nearly 40 years. Hi, Eileen. And Joan and Eileen were plaintiffs in a 1993 landmark New Jersey court case granting a lesbian couple a second parent adoption. Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine the generation that you have helped build families from this. And so their three grown children are legally have two mothers, whether they like it or not, which is the end of your bio. And I think it's perfect. Joan, welcome to the We Are For Good podcast. We're so excited you're here.
Thank you. You know, it's funny listening to your bio actually takes you on a little bit of a sort of a stroll down memory lane and how what seemed to be, and I think this is true for lots of people in their professional paths, that they don't actually know where they're going. But when you
100%.
Look back,
oh gosh, yes.
there are these things that weave together. And I always think about your professional trajectory as like this roller board of stuff you drag with you. And when I listen to you describe it, I like, oh, those things actually go together in some really interesting ways. So
career.
Thank you for sharing the bio and for allowing me to reflect on the path.
Well, that's wonderful. And we're just, you know, we're stewards sitting in the wake of what you've been building all of these decades. And I think, you know, it would be so helpful for our community to like just get to know Joan, the Joan behind the bio. Like, talk to us about you growing up. What was little Joan like? How did you get into this work? Talk to us about that fiery Irish woman.
Well, let me tell you about that feckin' fiery Irish woman, shall I? Okay. So Jonah is a little kid. I grew up. Here's another thing you didn't say in your bio, Becky. I grew up in Amityville, like of the Amityville horror on Long Island.
I've seen it.
Yes. So that's always a good conversation starter. I was the youngest and only girl of four. I have three older brothers. As I like to say, I am not exactly the girl my mother ordered. She wanted one so badly, but in some ways, I think I was actually my father's favorite son. Complex, but there it is. I am Catholic school educated, never in a classroom without a crucifix on the wall. I am a proud alum of Fordham University in the Bronx. Jesuits are not quite like priests. They're kind of a bridge between priests and rabbis, which probably explains why at the age of 60, I converted to Judaism, because I figured I was out about everything else in my life. So, oh my gosh. So here I am. I have both Catholic and Jewish guilt, and they are often in conflict with one another. I feel like I am the luckiest human on the planet. I never thought I would live happily ever after. I never thought I would have kids. So I had no intention of building what my team calls Jonelandia. I didn't have it. And I know we're going to talk about innovation and some of my own, that path you described of just like being an accidental consultant and now all of those things you described is a lot about innovation and a lot about creativity and seeing gaps and giving things a shot. And I could talk a little bit about even the derivation of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab and how we came to start that, and that it was actually one of those things that Michael Hyatt says, what challenging times make possible, right? But I was always a big mouth. I always had a lot to say. I'm a singer. I am the, here's another thing, not in the bio, you all. I was the first female singing member of the New York City Gay Men's Chorus. 250 gay men and me on the stage at Carnegie Hall. After I left GLAAD, I decided I wanted to learn how to blend and stick out all at the same time.
Amazing.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. So everything I do fills me with great joy. And I think I've always been that kind of person. And I'm a serious Yankee baseball fan. Okay. I have a very
Julie will love that
framed on my wall here in my office, a number of my best 1960s baseball cards. So that's another thing I really like. I am 66 years old, and so of course I play pickleball. And is that enough for now?
Oh, that's what a breath.
I know. And just like the human that you are, thank you for taking us a little bit into your journey, because we're obsessed with the journey around here. And I think seeing a like-minded friend, there's all of us are connected to you in some way in this. And that's what we want this conversation to be about, is that you do this through your work. You make us feel seen at all parts of the nonprofit journey. We have friends listening today that are in a shop of one person trying to hustle it out and trying to make it work. And we have people that are fighting the politics of bureaucracy of being in a massive team listening to this podcast.
Totally.
And I think they're both want the same things in the world in a lot of ways. And you get to be in this perch of getting to have all these conversations, having these life experiences. You think about innovation. You see the gaps that are there. Set some tone for us. I mean, what do you think about when you think about innovation in the nonprofit space? You know, how can we inject more of it to it? And what are you paying attention to?
So the one thing I do want to say is thinking about your listeners. So on the consulting side of things, my primary jam is executive coaching of CEOs of larger nonprofits. So I play in that sandbox. The Nonprofit Leadership Lab is a space for board and staff leaders of small to mid-sized nonprofits, right? So I have touch points with staff and board leaders of every size and shape nonprofit at every leg of their journey. And I think it's really important to say this before we jump into innovation, that there is no direct correlation between the size of your budget and the impact you are able to have in the world. I know really screwed up organizations with big fat budgets And I know badass organizations with little tiny budgets. So for those of you who have little tiny budgets, just know the object of the game is not to whoever has the most toys win. That's not what it's about. So I don't think the nonprofit sector is very good at innovation. Actually, I think it's one of its big pieces of kryptonite. I think of nonprofit leaders as superheroes, and I think they have a lot of superpowers, and I think innovation is a big piece of kryptonite. And I also think that the sooner we acknowledge that and sort of start to really dig into why that is and shift the mindset of nonprofit leaders, board, and staff, I think we can 10x or 100x the kind of impact that nonprofits have. Again, to say what challenging times make possible, I saw the greatest, the finest illustration of innovation and creativity. Agreed. During the pandemic. I saw staff leaders coaching clients of mine who were more fired up during the pandemic, even though it was hard as hell, because they were stretching new muscles, they were being creative, things that they'd never thought they could do in a short period of time, they did. So we know it can be done. And for me, the pandemic illustrated that business as usual was nothing to write home about.
Yeah. Wow.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, that's one of the trends we are going to highlight, is that business as usual is just over, you know, like
it's
there is
done.
No usual anymore. Yeah. So powerful.
I agree with you heartily. And it feels like without innovation, without, again, leaning into this moment instead of leaning away from it, those who are going to lean in are going to find sustainability. They're going to find new channels of revenue. They're going to find new ways of connection and building community. And I would just love to get your thoughts on what you believe are some of the hallmarks of an innovative, modern-day nonprofit. And what can people do to start to lean into that, Joan?
So one other quick thing. I believe that if we look at this sort of secret sauce behind all the innovation during the pandemic, and I gave a keynote speech to the folks at the YMCA in Atlanta this summer, and I got them talking about why they weren't like that before, why they weren't taking risks, and why was it different? And what I heard over and over again is that their need to deliver for their communities or their causes was greater than their fear. I heard a lot about fear, right? I heard a lot about fear of not having sufficient, you know, fear that stems from the scarcity mindset that the nonprofit sector is riddled with. And so you asked me, what are the hallmarks of what are we shooting for, right? What does success look like? If I see these things, I know that this organization has some real opportunity to innovate in really interesting ways. And I would say it kind of starts at the sort of this very top. And you all some of you have read some of my stuff and know that I don't think of nonprofits as hierarchical. I think of them more like twin engine jets with a board engine and a staff engine and the board chair and the executive director in the cockpit. Right? It's a very different model. It's not hierarchical. I also think about partnerships as being a central philosophical, unique secret sauce in nonprofits. And if you think about it that way, I need, in an innovative organization, I want to see a board that has moved from a mindset of risk management to one of thought partnership. Boards stay on the tarmac, to use my jet metaphor, and we keep them in the weeds and they stay there. It is not the best use of them. And it, in fact, is actually counterproductive to innovation. I am looking for a staff leader who has, and I got this from a interview I did with the chief people officer of Charity Water. They look for humble confidence in their leaders. I love that. Humble confidence, who understands the importance of a culture of learning and growth. who is not afraid to say, the culture I want in this organization is one in which we provide you with the tools and the skills to have difficult conversations so that we can agree, disagree, and take diverse points of view and lived experience and make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. And a staff leader that recognizes that investing in professional development is not a luxury item. And then I guess I would also say an organization that invests in building a culture of storytelling. Amazingly enough, staff and boards of nonprofit organizations are not very good storytellers. I sat next to somebody at a dinner one night, some fundraiser, and I said, you know, so what do you do? And this woman ran a nonprofit, and I said, oh, tell me about it. 20 minutes later, the woman was still talking to me. Finally, I stopped her and I said, you may regret the day they placed us next to each other at this dinner, but would you be able to do that again? Pretend I'm 15 years old and you only have 10 minutes.
Very smart.
Right. And it was so much better. It was so much better. Now, you'd think that that woman would walk away and I never heard from her again. But no, of course, she hired me as a client. And but it was, you know, it is, we want to say everything and everything is not the correct answer. And so really building and exercising the storytelling muscle throughout your organization so that you have a grand posse of storytellers who are ambassadors, who can get out there and invite more people to know and do something with, who want to come closer and closer and closer. That's what you all should be in the business of doing. John, are you smirking?
I am so happy right now because you're preaching our values back to us. I'm smiling like a little kid over here because we're a growth mindset community. That's what we want to start in this space and cultivate, not start, just gather people like that because we all don't know these things intrinsically. But together with the posture of this humble confidence, we can come together and be better storytellers and be better partners in our, with our board and figure this stuff out together in real time. Like, you're just talking about the things that I love in this world so much. And I wonder, I want to go back to your cool case study. I mean, GLAAD has been this chapter of your career. We look at this. I just think we all went through the pandemic and that's right when Becky and I were making the jump to We Are For Good. It was that summer. So we had that moment of sitting in the nonprofit to be like, what do we actually do right now? You know, I know that sinking feeling of confidence to confusion. So I just think you were having a similar experience walking in to this place that is literally out of money, that has a such important mission, such an inflection point in history to like step into. What did you do? I mean, how did you cultivate that growth mindset and pull people together to, you know, lead it to the impacts and prominence that it has today?
So I had no idea there was only $360 in the bank. I didn't ask for financials because I know myself. And if I knew it was really in bad shape, I would want the job more.
Really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, come on. My podcast is called Nonprofits Are Messy. I deal with, like, a client will come forth and my team will say, oh, this one is really messy. And I'm like, really? Let's hear about it. I actually began by making it clear to the board that I had no intention of laying anyone off. And that this mess happened on their watch and that they were going to be partners with me in digging out. Now, remember that I had been hired with no fundraising experience. My development director at the time was horrified because the other candidate had a lot of fundraising experience, but I had media background. I was a very good public speaker. I was very clear and articulate about why focusing on the media mattered so much. And so I got in front of people at every opportunity and I was bold in asking for money. So did I ask for money to dig the car out of the ditch? Uh-uh. No. What I did was I painted a picture of where we wanted GLAAD to go.
Oh, here it is. Keep That's going. Great. Keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So I said, okay, I have come to an organization that has been for, you know, X number of years has been a media watchdog, a finger wagging organization. No, that's defamatory. No, that's offensive. And I believed that if we actually built our credibility as an organization and put the right people on the bus, we could start having proactive conversations with producers and journalists to actually help them get it right, so that we could give them props for getting it right. We had a media awards ceremony, which was the most mission-centric gala, so that we could then honor people who got it right. And we could, I made the argument we could do both. We could wag our fingers and celebrate, and that we could actually get on the inside and make a difference. And people were all over that, right? Why do I have to wag my finger when the damage has already been done to the hearts and minds of people who are not with us?
Yeah.
And so I sold that. But I'm going to tell you, I knew nothing really about the programs of GLAAD for that first year. I sold that. I then also, we were particularly known for entertainment media. And at that time, we had a kind of a celebrity doing that work. And so I used that to get in. The other thing that I did is I was wildly transparent with my team about the condition of the finances. And I used to have weekly meetings where I referred to the organization as if it was a patient in a hospital. And I would say, we're still in the ICU, but we're breathing on our own, right? And so I kind of created a culture of we're all in this together. And and then I'm a huge fan of I'm a huge fan of quick wins, and I can actually look around corners. That's people call that anticipating. And I arrived just after Ellen came out on national television, which was not on my watch.
I remember that.
And I arrived just before the murder of Matthew Shepard. And I believed that we had a role to play in shaping how the story came out of Laramie, Wyoming, by putting people on the ground, by training college students to say the right things to the media. And the story got shaped out of Laramie in a way that was very different, and I think way more was fair, accurate, and compelling to national audiences. And I'm also a big fan of, okay, is there a thing we can grab onto that we can build on? We don't have money. I remember talking to Malcolm Gladwell. I called him.
I love that. Phone a friend. What a good phone a friend.
Yeah, totally an amazing phone a friend.
This is my wife. This is all about my wife. I make no mistake. I said, I really want to know what Malcolm Gladwell thinks the tipping point would be for attitudes and opinions about LGBT people.
Yeah.
He's the expert.
She said, why don't you call him? Why don't you call him? I'm like, do you think he'd take my call? She said, oh, I totally think he'd take your call. And he did take my call. And he said, you know what? You're never going to have enough money for the Nike swoosh. You've got to actually step on a platform that's been created for you or build a platform. And we took on talk show host Laura Schlesinger. We used that to build a list, to mobilize people. My favorite story, and this to me, I don't think of this as innovation. I think of it as seizing opportunities, and maybe that's the same thing, right? My director of communications got married in L.A., and I said, so did you, this was way back when, did you submit it to the L.A. Times wedding section? And we laughed, right? Because that just didn't happen. And I said, why didn't you? Why don't you? And then I went to a cocktail party where I met the publisher of the New York Times. And I said, can we talk about same-sex wedding announcements in the New York Times? And the man said to me, I know that I am standing on an ever-shrinking island of tradition. And I said, well, that actually my job is to either shrink the island or nudge you gently off of it. And several years later, we got the New York Times to include same-sex couples on its wedding announcements. We are also responsible for the first gay castaway on Survivor, and I'm Survivor addict.
What season was that?
That was season one, okay. And he actually won.
What?
Yes.
I picked it up in season two.
I remember. Yeah. Totally.
And then he went to jail. I take no responsibility for that. But I think, this is, you have to have your your eyes open. You can't have your head down. I use this phrase, raising your gaze, right? Is you got to look down the road. And I, by the way, there are a lot of people out there that have cars that are stuck in ditches. I know this. And the moral of my story is it's okay to say you're in a ditch, but you have to actually tell them, I really want to go to Yosemite. Right, John?
Yeah.
I really want to go to Yosemite. Mm-hmm. Right? Do you want to come with me? And if so, could you help us bridge from where we are now so that the car is in order so we can go on the ride? And I tell you what, that strategy secures more multi-year gifts, unrestricted, than you can possibly imagine. It's a golden tactic because it's smart and it's right. Mm. People want to know where you're going.
Joan Gary, I like you so much. Will you come over and be one of my dear friends? Because you are talking at a level that I don't think we talk at enough in this sector. First of all, there is no scarcity in what you're saying at all.
None.
There is abundant thinking. You had $360 in the bank, but you were an incredible storyteller that forecasted the future that you wanted to co-build with your believers. I want to say that I value all of this. And if you are listening out there and you feel like your car is in the ditch, you feel like your nonprofit is on life support, you feel like you only have $360 in the bank and you're wondering where it's coming from, I believe that Joan just gave you a very impressive, succinct, and I would say time-honored strategy there of how do we start to cast the vision and ask our believers to come along and believe that they can be a part of the change that we want to build. And I believe that that is such a brilliant starting point if you're looking for the next phase to get yourself not only out of the ditch, but y'all, to build something that scales and succeeds and changes the world. And I want to pivot a little bit into next year, because I think, you know, the clock turns over from New Year's Eve to New Year's. And I think that there's a sort of wind out of their sails that happens to the sector. Everybody's exhausted from year end. Everybody's exhausted. And it's like the KPIs start back at zero. And I want people, because I see it and I believe it, to have hope that this could be a year that things could really change for the better, and that you have the power to seize that. So talk to us a little bit about strategic planning for the new year. Give us some of your practical tips, maybe some steps that nonprofit leaders can take to integrate innovation into their planning for the new year and really come out and cast that vision that you're talking about in a way that makes people want to be a magnet to it.
Okay, so let's start with the word strategic planning. Right.
One of my most hated words of all time, confession.
So I have done a couple of podcasts on a process that that I engage in called strategic visioning, which is basically, do we have alignment around whether we're going to Yosemite or Disneyland? Right?
Two different experiences.
So, yeah. Right. Very different experiences. And I think I think strategic plans are generally work plans filled with OKRs. And they suck every bit of generative creative juice out of a process that should be fueling. It should fill everyone's tank.
And I love that you just said generative creative, because that's such a buzzword in AI. Let's not let AI be the generative. This is in the minds and hearts of the people in our organizations right now.
You know, I think about this, and I do think a lot of it starts with your board and how you engage with your board, right? So we all know that there's three levels of governance: fiduciary, strategic, and generative. Most boards are lucky to get to strategic, but if they get to generative conversations, where those are what I call the "what if" conversations, where you kind of just sustain, you forget what you know about the organization and talk only about what you imagine to be possible. Sort of what I would consider the, you know, if a game-changing gift landed on your doorstep, what would you do with it and why, right? Then we don't have those conversations, except maybe at board retreats, and then they just fall off the radar. So we don't exercise that muscle with people. So the first thing I do with strategic planning is I wouldn't call it strategic planning. And I would ask big, bold, hairy questions to my board and let them actually ideate about those. There's another word that's a little jargony. Sorry about that. I would educate my board. I would actually do a case study and say the before times, the pandemic times. I've been wanting boards. I've been wanting staff, nonprofits to do this for a long time because the board members didn't really understand what happened. Not all of them, but because we were too busy doing the thing to tell them about the thing, right? I had a client who ran the Jewish Federation of Minneapolis. George Floyd was killed blocks from his office, right? He became a community leader, a collaborator, right? It was awesome what Jim did. And then I said, your board must be so proud. And I'm like, he's like, I wish I had time to tell them. I'm like, oh. So I made him pick up his cell phone and I said, okay, just start talking into your cell phone, but make a video and just go for 3 to 5 minutes. And then I want you to send it to every one of your board members. And actually we called it Did You Knows? And they loved them because they were in the loop, right? Did you know? Did you know that today, and it isn't like today we scored a $20,000 gift. It was today we were at a table in Minneapolis with leaders of faith and blah, 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 right? So board education, marketing innovation to board members so they understand its value because I don't think they totally get it because we don't do a very good job of educating them. So strategic visioning, not strategic planning. Marketing innovation to the board. The third thing is something that may seem a little odd, but it's about budgeting.
Okay.
By the time a budget gets to a board, it should be relatively balanced. And that means things you really, really wanted to do got cut. Right? Okay. Because the difference between the revenue and the expense was too high, was too different, right? So they never see those exciting things you were going to do because you didn't have the money.
Okay. This is so huge, Joan. Yeah, keep going. Keep
right?
Going.
Okay. So they see the budget and they're like, okay, that revenue covers that expense. And then they focus on what variance percentage they have in each area. And they do their financial steward due diligence, fiduciary role. I want a board presentation that says, here's where we're going to be on New Year's Eve as a result of this money that we invest, as a result of this money we raise. Here is a list of the initiatives we wanted to include but did not have the funding for. Right? Watch them go, oh, we really need to do that thing. Why? Really?
I really want to go to Yosemite. Is it.
We're never going to get to Yosemite if we don't do this. Mm. Right? So all of a sudden, there's a list of these really good goodies. And so I, as the board chair, I'm like, okay, what needs to be different? Could we look at where we're at each quarter? And if we're running ahead, and it now gives the board some incentive to invite more people to the party, right? Could we add some of these in? And if we can't add them in altogether, could we pilot? And piloting to me is the key that unlocks the door. Because you set up a pilot for something that you want, that you believe will have greater impact, right? You set out what success metrics look like at the front end. You illustrate proof of concept. You present that to your board. You then have proof of concept for your board and for funding. We tried this in a small scale. Look what it did.
Yeah.
Right. And what I also think it does is it actually addresses some of the risk management boards do. That they come to with a little bit of a DNA and that sort of, I join a board to make sure nothing goes wrong, right? But they like trying new things. They do. They just don't like investing in big things that feel overwhelming. The pilot is the way to go. And so I want people, as they're setting goals for the year, I always think that budgets are the tool by which you achieve your goals. I've never understood anybody who approved a budget and then put together organizational goals for the year. That's asked backward in my book. And remember, I came from the private sector and I did a lot of finance and budgeting. And this, you know, I was actually, one of my gigs was, which you missed, Becky. I worked for Showtime for 8 years and I managed a joint venture between Showtime and Don King.
Oh my gosh.
What did that even look? Okay, uh-huh. Put a pin in that. We're talking about that next time you come back.
Okay, great.
I need to know that story.
But I became known as the person who could figure out what story the numbers were telling. And they actually deployed me into the finance department to train the finance analysts all through Showtime on how to write a kick-ass cover memo for monthly financials that actually made the business unit, the VPs who ran the business units, actually understand the story the numbers are telling. So anyway, these are the things that I think about when I think about, as you go into 2023, set your, what I call your New Year's Eve bucket list, not a list of to-dos, but the 5-10 headlines you want to raise a glass of toast and say, I had a kick-ass year. We did these 7 things and they were awesome. And I want you to think about budgeting in terms of making sure the board understands what you are not able to do, not in a whiny way, right? But in a motivating way. And I want you to start to think about introducing the idea of pilots and harken back to the pandemic, because it was one big, as me people would say, one big feckin' pilot.
Okay, we got to talk about semantics on this, because pilot is innovation. Pilot is equitable. Pilot is bringing things in that have not been considered before. I think this is such a brilliant tactic. And the only thing I want to tell you to add to it is ask your board members how they can help.
Yes.
They need a role in enacting this innovation. Yes, we're going to work as a team to enact and to test. I mean, this is like marketing is mission right here. Like, we're going to figure out what works and what responds, but we're going to need the collective to come with us. And it can't just be staff led. It can't just be our ideas. It's got to be a part of the collective. That was very wise, John.
I love that. I take the friendly amendment and say that that's what board members want, that we don't often give them, is a definition of what success looks like. They want to be successful people. They are drawn to board service to be successful. You do a working group around a pilot that's staff and board driven, and the idea is to create the success metrics, right? To monitor it, to then have that working group, including the board members, do a show and tell at a board meeting about what we're learning from that pilot. They get the spotlight, right? They get to do show and tell in front of other board members. They feel like they're doing something really interesting, innovative, and finite. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when they leave the board, one of the things they can say is, I was really part of transforming the culture of this organization into one of innovation. And let me give you an example. We did a pilot of a blah, blah, blah in 2023. I was part of a staff board working group. And it was actually a lot of work, but it was that kind of work that puts gas into your tank, not the kind that takes gas out of your tank.
I mean, to quote Joan, you said earlier, how do we move from risk management to thought partnership? That is a superpower waiting to be unleashed in every single one of our boardrooms, in every organization. So this conversation has got me fired up, my friend. Like, yep. Thank you for this. But you know, one of our core tenets is we love just the power of simple philanthropy in our daily lives. And we create space for stories. And I just can't imagine the stories that have moved your heart. But I wonder if you'd take us back to one in your journey. Like, when's a moment that of philanthropy that's really stuck with you?
I love that she's giggled. So I could choose a lot of them, but there's just one story. And I believe it's a story about treating your stakeholders as human beings, as partners, and being in relationship with them. Because you asked about philanthropy particularly, so this is what prompted me. So I hope this isn't going to be too long a story, but it's good, so it might be worth it.
Go for it.
Got us.
Okay. GLAAD Media Awards are these rather big spectacles, celebrities, et cetera, doing one in San Francisco. And because we take up the most of the hotel, the hotel gave me a very nice suite. Okay. I didn't need a suite, but I had a suite. And I had a bunch of, I have a couple of my board members and senior staff over for wine and cheese. Our biggest donor at that time was a gentleman whose house was so big, it was his own zip code. And he was a little bit unpredictable. And I pick up the phone in the suite, and it is that donor who says, "I've decided to come to the Media Awards tonight. I'm a little, just so you know, there's really not a suite available for me." He had a private plane, et cetera. "There's not a suite available for me." And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Let me see what I can do. Let me call down to the front desk and see what's going on." And I hung up the phone, and that was the only suite. And that was the suite he would want. And I said, "We're about 20 minutes from the airport. We have about 12 minutes put this suite back together so it looks like no one has ever been in it.
Take the lampshade and I had off board your members, head, like put everything back.
I had these like very demure board members throwing knives with brie into their backpack. Like I had one board member who was folding the toilet paper into the triangles. Like it was comedic. So in
who's
12
good
minutes,
with the fitted sheets?
Yeah, like, in 12 minutes, and I don't think I had actually slept in the bed. I had been there for the day, right? So in 12 minutes, we're out. I've got my rollerboard. We come out of the elevator and we see him coming down the hall.
No.
Right? Because we then tell the front desk, the suite should go to him. So they put me in a different room and I get my jammies because it's going to be a long day the next day. The phone rings. It's him. He said, "You gave up your suite. You left your suite." I said, "How'd you know?" And he said, "Because I asked for your room number when I called the hotel, and it happened to be the room number of the suite." And I said, "Yeah, well, you weren't really, you really weren't supposed to know that. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you tomorrow." And he says, "Can you meet me at the hotel bar in 15 minutes? So I woke up another one of my colleagues and I said, I don't know what's going to be happening in 15 minutes, but can you come down to the bar with me?" He said, "No one has treated me as a real human being without trying to get credit for it, for some means to an end, for a larger gift, or treated me in some transactional way. You actually vacated that suite. I bet you did it in 10 minutes. And you didn't want me to know." And the man said, "I'm going to give you $3 million.
Oh my gosh.
And he said, I love GLAAD. I love what you do. But a kind of leadership board and staff that actually, that embraces a culture that says we see our stakeholders as humans, as people who are partners with us in our work. I want a bigger investment in that." It's a good story, right? Especially the toilet paper and the knives with the brie on it.
I'm like picturing you as he says that, like reaching into your bag to grab a hanky and there's melted brie in there. Like there's so much going on in my head right now.
Yeah.
But the humanity that is centered in that story, I know people think this is sometimes perceived as toxic optimism, but just letting somebody be themselves, showing kindness, letting them feel their humanity and responding to that, it is the great balm, I think, on the soul. And I just think that whether he had given you $3 million or whether he had given you a hug, like I think that conversation exchange probably profoundly changed you, I would guess.
It did. It actually made me take the suite at every hotel I stayed at.
No. Just no. Waiting for that.
No.
Call.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in case. No. Now there are, by the way, I bet there are people who are listening to that who say, you jumped through hoops for your biggest donor. And that's that, like, they might hear that story differently. And there's potentially some truth in their truth, right? But that's how I see that story. And everybody that had anything to do with that the next day, they were absolutely glowing. Like,
that
Karen
was a team
pulled
effort.
Out that knife. She kept the knife with debris on it. I have debris to prove it.
Oh my gosh.
I think it's just like, be kind. Yeah. Be kind.
Yeah.
Right? When you have a house as big as a zip code, people don't treat you like a human. They treat you like an ATM.
Yeah.
And that's true of board members who give generously or who raise their hand and you don't actually engage them. Right? Everybody, a volunteer, a staff member, they came because they care, because they want to be enriched. They want to be informed about the issue. They want to be seen as understanding more deeply the systemic problems that underlie the issues that you work on every day. They're in love with your organization when they come. And if they aren't, you shouldn't invite them to come.
Yeah.
And then your job is to make sure that they are continually given the opportunity to love it up all the more.
I love every bit of that. I love all of you and what you're about, which makes it very sad for me to pitch the last question to you here, which is we wrap up all of our conversations with a one good thing.
Yeah, good.
Piece of advice, a life hack, something that somebody could leave with that just gets them activated today. What would be your one good thing, Joan?
I think it kind of connects to a lot of the things that I've said today. I want you to start to think like a partner. That you, as a person who runs an organization, the power doesn't come from you. The power comes from all around you. It comes from your donors, your volunteers, the people who you mobilize to take action, to lobby, the folks who show up for your concert, right? The power comes from around you, and that's a privileged position. And being an orchestra of that power by actually really thinking of them as partners with you in this work will create a lasting relationship, will make every one of those people feel heard, and they will have good ideas. And if you don't treat them like partners, you do that at your own peril, because people equals power. The more people you invite to your party, the more power you have. And those people will stay at your party a good long while if they feel like their voice matters and that you actually work in partnership with them.
Gosh, I love that thread. And it's been true of all of your experiences and even how you tone set and talked about the small nonprofits coming together in your work. So I want to round out and just give you the chance to say, how can people connect with you, the Nonprofit Leadership Lab? Obviously, click over and subscribe to Joan's podcast. Nonprofits are messy if you're not already. But, how can people reach out to you, connect with your team?
JoanGary.com is sort of all things Joan Landia. you can link up to the blog and the podcast and learn more about my coaching services. The Nonprofit Leadership Lab, it's called nonprofitleadershiplab.com, where you can learn about the professional, modest professional development resources, both content and community, but small leaders of small board and staff. And we have an increasing number of board members as part of we have currently about 5,200 members. We have supported about 20,000 since 2017.
Wow. Thank you.
Awesome.
And by the way, it all started because I was getting calls to my personal cell phone from leaders of small nonprofits who went to my website, could not afford me, who wanted to know if I knew any board members in Montana, if I knew a funder in Cincinnati. And I went to my digital marketing partner and I said, there's so many of them out there. And he said, why don't we build an online membership site so that you can scale what you do? and offer them both content and community so they don't feel alone and they feel a sense of moral support. And we opened the doors in May of 2017, and we thought it would be cool if we got 300 people. And, you know, it was like $30 a head per month. It's more now, but not a lot more. And almost 1,000 people joined sight unseen, not even knowing what the thing was. And almost 200 of those people are still members today.
Wow.
Joan Gary, I just adore you. I cannot believe it took 3 years of the podcast for us to meet. I hope it is shorter the next time you come on.
Me too. Invite me back.
We'll be happy to continue
the conversation.
We absolutely will. And I hope everyone out there got as much from this conversation and know that you're not alone in this. I want to give like a free mom hug out here. You have got this in 2024. It is a new era. You are capable of this. And if you feel overwhelmed, please find community. You can always come to the We Are for Good community. You can go to the Nonprofit Lab community. There are communities everywhere. We want you to find your people because no one needs to go at this alone. And guess what? When we lean in, that's when the magic is going to happen. So don't lean out, friends. Let's lean in. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you very much, Becky and John. This was a really fun conversation.
Thanks so much for being here, friends. And you probably hear it in our voices, but we love connecting you with the most innovative people to help you achieve more for your mission than ever before.
We'd love for you to come join our good community. It's free, and you can think of it as the after party to each podcast episode. Sign up today at weareforgood.com/hello.
And one more thing, if you love what you heard today, would you mind leaving us a podcast rating and review? It means the world to us, and your support helps more people find this community. Thanks so much, friends. Can't wait to our next conversation. Rabbit fans have always powered the We Are For Good podcast, but now Rabbit fans can get even more goodness and access by joining Good Friends. It's our listener support community for the We Are For Good podcast.
Good Friends comes with perks, exclusive episodes with John and I, including The Good Brief, our new monthly cliff notes of the greatest takeaways and lessons learned from that month, and exclusive AMA episodes where we answer your burning questions and tap our community of experts. Join now or learn more at weareforgood.com/friends.
We can't wait to see you inside. That's weareforgood.com/friends.